community as well as businesses and faith houses of worship that have been contributing to the fund as well. So we will continue with a public process, stakeholder participation in giving the Reparation Committee direction on what they believe remedy is for the Black community in Evanston. Of course, we'll have to do that in line with our purview as a municipal government and in line with our local case for reparations, which has been developed by Shorefront Legacy Center and Dino's team. But one thing that will continue to remain a process is our national partners, namely NCOBRA. NCOBRA has supported our community by participating and leading and educating our residents, and we're really grateful. But we will continue with the public process to determine the next $9,600,000.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Evanston City Councilmember Robin Ruth Simmons, Dino Robinson of the Shorefront Legacy Center, and Danny Glover, actor and activist. Have a safe trip from Vancouver to Bessemer, Alabama today. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Wearing a mask is an act of love. Where to?
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO has a number of special t-shirts we've created just for you during our month of special programming. Whether you are a metalhead, a punk rocker, a bluegrass fan, or a feminist, we have a t-shirt for you. Wear it proudly in support of KBOO Community Radio. Go to kboo.fm/t-shirts to see all the designs. All proceeds go to support the work of KBOO Community Radio.
Now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two Oregon brothers have been indicted and arrested on charges associated with the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. The Oregon Children's Museum has announced that it will close after 75 years, and an Idaho representative suggests replacing Snake River dams with nuclear power. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 26th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. The FBI announced that two Oregon brothers have been arrested for their participation in the riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. On Tuesday, Matthew Klein, 24, was arrested in Sherwood, and Jonathan Peter Klein, 21, was arrested near Heppner. They are the first Oregonians to be arrested and charged for their role in the insurrection that sought to prevent Congress from certifying the 2020 election results for President Joe Biden. The two were indicted by a grand jury and face six charges, including conspiracy, destruction of government property, entering a restricted building, and obstruction of law enforcement during a civil disorder. According to the charges, the brothers flew to Philadelphia on January 4th and traveled to Washington, D.C. the next day. The documents say that the Kleins climbed a wall and helped others to get to the upper terrace of the Capitol. They then entered the building with other members of the Proud Boys before forcing a door open on the north side. Matthew Klein then moved on police officers with the flagpole carrying the Gadsden flag, the image of the coiled rattlesnake with the words, "Don't tread on me." Prior to the Capitol riots, the brothers also exhibited violent behavior at protests in both Salem and Portland. On September 7th, the brothers participated in a rally that turned violent at the Oregon State Capitol. Photos appear to show Jonathan Peter Klein in body armor while he carries a baseball bat and paintball gun during protests. He was recorded by reporters from OPB while apparently chasing a Black Lives Matter protester. Matthew Klein is currently facing charges in Multnomah County for being in possession of a loaded gun at a late September Proud Boys rally in Portland. The brothers will appear before a judge in Washington, D.C., where their cases are being transferred. Yesterday, the Oregon Senate passed a bill that would allow cities and counties to ban guns in public buildings across the state. Under current state law, those with a concealed handgun license can carry their weapons into public buildings, including schools and airports. The bill does not impose restrictions on an individual's right to obtain a concealed carry license, but if SB 554 becomes law, local governments would be allowed to ban all firearms in public buildings. During a floor speech, Democratic Senator Ginny Burdick of Portland referenced the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, as well as the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She also spoke of the day in 2019 when armed protesters appeared at the Capitol in Salem to oppose gun bills, saying, quote, "We had more panic buttons going off that day than any other time in my time in the legislature." She pointed out that gun bans already exist in federal buildings and courthouses, and that city and county buildings should be able to implement those same limitations. Burdick expressed particular concern about guns in schools, saying, quote, "I've talked to school people in my district who have begged parents not to bring their guns into the schools. The parent, in one case, refused, and they have no recourse." Republican senators made 7 motions to table the bill, refer it to various committees, or postpone the proposal indefinitely, but all failed. Predictably, the bill brought a strong negative response from the Oregon Republican Party. In a statement, Oregon GOP Vice Chairman Herman Bartschiger said, quote, "This bill is a direct attack on gun owners and our Second Amendment." But recent polling suggests that nearly 60% of Oregonians agree that local governments should be allowed to ban guns in public buildings. The bill now heads to the House. If it passes, it is expected that Governor Brown will sign it into law. In 1991, voters in Oregon passed Measure 11, which set mandatory minimum sentences for an array of serious felonies. The measure also prevented the reduction of prison time for good behavior and was another example of the wave of strict sentencing measures that voters passed nationwide in the 90s. But earlier this week, Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt spoke out against minimum sentencing for felonies other than murder. Senate Bill 401 would do away with mandatory minimums and allow courts to impose shorter sentences. And in testimony to the Oregon Senate earlier this week, Schmidt called the bill, quote, "arguably the most important public safety bill in recent memory." He went on to say, quote, "We've learned that much of what we believed was true nearly 3 decades ago was not only untrue, but actively harmful, creating deep systems of inequity that we are still wrestling with today." Washington County District Attorney Kevin Barton doesn't agree with Schmidt and wants to see Measure 11 remain in place. In a statement, Barton said, quote, "I urge you to think about the crime victims, the ones that come into my lobby wondering, am I going to be protected?" But if passed, SB 401 would simply allow judges to impose more lenient sentences on deserving defendants. It would not limit their ability to impose harsh sentences when they believe it to be appropriate. SB 401 is one of at least 3 bills attempting to undo Measure 11 that have been introduced in the current legislative session. The pandemic has claimed another victim as the Portland Children's Museum announced that it will close the museum as well as the Opal School. The board of directors voted to close the museum and school, citing attendance and revenue losses that left it financially incapable of reopening. Directors decided that the state's guidelines on limited capacity, the cost of enhanced cleaning protocols, and the need to rehire 50 staff positions meant reopening the 75-year-old institution wouldn't be possible in a post-pandemic world. During its lifetime, 4.8 million people visited the museum. Many who first visited as children returned as parents or grandparents. Laura Huerta Miguez is the executive director of the Association of Children's Museums. Upon hearing the news, she said, quote, "The closure of a children's museum is devastating to the social fabric of a community, and the loss of Portland Children's Museum will be felt for years to come." The Opal School was the first charter school approved by Portland Public Schools. In its 20 years, it served more than 500 students and also provided continuing learning programs to over 10,000 educators. The museum will be closed down over the next few months, and supplies will be donated to local nonprofits. Some Oregonians hit the pandemic equivalent of the lotto on Monday when they were mistakenly informed that they were eligible to get an appointment to receive the COVID vaccine. All for Oregon sent emails to 11,000 people inviting them to schedule a vaccination appointment at the Oregon Convention Center. However, the recipients were not scheduled to become eligible until April 19th. But on Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority admitted the mistake, saying that erroneous information had been sent to All for Oregon, the group of hospitals that are helping to manage the vaccinations at the convention center. Some recipients were concerned that their appointments might prevent others from getting their vaccination, but OHA says the appointments will be honored. Approximately 25,000 vaccinations per day are being given at the convention center. Roughly 6,000 to 7,000 are being given by All for Oregon, so the error equates to a less than 2-day delay. Yesterday, members of the Northwest Tribal Salmon Alliance called on the government to remove 4 dams on the Snake River to help restore salmon runs. The letter, which was sent to President Joe Biden and members of Congress from Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, called the potential extinction of salmon in the river a, quote, "moral failure of the highest order." The 14 dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers produce about 40% of the region's power, providing enough electricity for 5 million homes. A 2020 government report rejected the removal of the dams. The report stated that removal would destabilize the power grid, increase greenhouse gas emissions, and dramatically increase the risk of regional power outages. But for the fish, the dams are a nightmare. Salmon hatch in freshwater streams before migrating to the ocean, where they spend years. Then, just before the end of their lives, they return to the freshwater streams where they mate and lay eggs before dying. The dams present an almost insurmountable obstacle to their migration. Regional Republicans generally oppose removing the dams, but last month, Idaho Republican Representative Mike Simpson called for spending $33 billion to breach the dams and to replace the transportation, irrigation, and power generation the dams provide. For more on this, here's Eric Tagadoff with the Public News Service.
Nuclear energy could be part of the mix to replace power from 4 lower Snake River dams if they're removed. Idaho Congressman Mike Simpson's plan calls for removing the 4 dams to aid the ailing salmon populations of the Northwest. Small modular reactors to produce nuclear energy could play a role in replacing their hydropower. Ian Cotton with the Snake River Alliance says the proposal also touches on increasing renewable energy, transmission capacity, and energy efficiency.
Those are all things that really excite us at the prospect of those becoming a bigger piece of our Northwest's energy infrastructure. But as far as the role of small modular reactors goes with this plan, it really feels like to us it's a piece that doesn't quite fit with the rest of the puzzle.
The $33 billion plan includes $10 billion for energy replacement once the dams are removed. Some environmental groups say nuclear power needs to be part of the energy makeup in order to decarbonize the economy in the coming decades. Don Safer, co-chair of the Sierra Club Nuclear Free Campaign, says energy isn't the only product of the industry. It also produces radioactive waste.
There's just this debit to the future that we're creating this material that we don't really know how to dispose of, and the problems will become more and more pronounced as we go forward.
Simpson's Northwest Infrastructure Plan would modernize the region's energy sector, bringing more renewables online. Safer says the small modular reactor design proposed for nuclear projects is still unproven technology, meaning the return on investment may not be as much as people assume.
The small modular reactors are just not a good choice, especially in the West, where you have plenty of solar, you have plenty of wind, and the money would be better spent developing better cost-effective storage technology, which is coming.
Simpson's plan could be included in a massive infrastructure package the Biden administration is putting together. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, tune in for The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, it'll be cloudy and cold with an overnight low in the high 30s. Tomorrow, we can look forward to a mix of clouds and sun with an afternoon high in the low 60s. On this day in 1953, Dr. Jonas Salk announced that he had successfully tested a vaccine against polio. Today's quote is from Dr. Salk. When asked who owned the patent, he replied, quote, "Well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" The murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is set to begin on Monday, but another video of police brutality in the area has many worried that the Minneapolis police has not made meaningful change since George Floyd's murder. For more, it's Georgia Fort with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Minneapolis community leaders are demanding the firing of an officer caught on camera using what they say was excessive force.
We demand an immediate termination. He gotta go! He gotta go!
A four-minute video recorded Wednesday that's now gone viral shows a man being slammed to the ground and punched several times by police.
This is police brutality, bro. Stop, gang, step back. Hey, stop, why'd you hit him?
During a press conference Thursday, the Minneapolis police chief explained what he believes led up to the incident.
A violent felony carjacking occurred in the city of New Hope. Eventually, that vehicle was picked up by Robbinsdale Police Department. It made its way into Minneapolis.
Meanwhile, community leaders held their own press conference in front of the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis, where they shared concerns about the state of the Minneapolis Police Department. They say it's in the same condition it was when Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd. Among those present was the young man who recorded the video. He said this is not the first time he's witnessed police brutality.
If we already hurt him, why still hurt us?
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly the point.
According to Mayor Fry, the incident is being investigated by Internal Affairs. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
Yesterday, Georgia Republicans passed a sweeping new law to restrict voting access in the state. The law introduces rigid voter ID requirements for absentee ballots, limits the number and location of drop boxes, and expands the state legislature's power over elections. Georgia is one of the first Republican battleground states to impose strict new voter laws in the wake of the defeat of Donald Trump in the November general election. Iowa has already imposed stiffer restrictions, and Arizona, Texas, and Florida are also pushing ahead with efforts to restrict voting. Democrats and voting rights groups have condemned such efforts, arguing that they unfairly target voters of color. They say the new law in Georgia particularly seeks to make voting harder for the state's large Black population, which was crucial to President Biden's triumph in Georgia in November, as well as the success of Senators Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff in the January runoff elections. Biden joined Georgia Democrats in denouncing the new law and called Republican efforts to limit voting around the country, quote, the most pernicious thing. In yesterday's news conference, he said, quote, this makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. The vote passed through the Georgia legislature along a party line vote and was signed into law by Republican Governor Brian Kemp before the day was done. The Washington state legislature is considering a bill that would require farm workers to be paid overtime. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service.
Washington state farm workers could be poised to receive overtime pay under a measure in the legislature. Senate Bill 5172 would phase in, starting with overtime pay for more than 55 hours of work per week in 2022, and would be completely implemented for more than 40 hours of work in 2024. Marciano Sanchez with Familias Unidas por la Justicia says people work as much as 80 hours a week, sometimes for minimum wage, and come home exhausted.
Especially having to work in the summer when temperatures get to 100 degrees sometimes. People aren't supposed to be out there 10 to 12 hours a day working that kind of conditions.
Senate Bill 5172 originally was designed to protect farmers from liability for paying farm workers because of a state Supreme Court decision that ruled denying agricultural laborers overtime was unconstitutional. As a compromise, lawmakers have agreed to phase in overtime pay on farms. The bill is scheduled for an executive session today in the House Committee on Labor and Workplace Standards. Joe Kindo with the Washington State Labor Council says agriculture workers were excluded from overtime protections in federal law during New Deal negotiations, and the exclusion has racist roots. Southern states wanted to carve out these workers because most of them were Black. Kindo notes that the bill isn't just about putting farm workers on equal footing with other workers.
It really is fundamentally, I think, a health and safety and public health issue, as much as it is a wage equity issue.
Farmers opposed to the bill have argued it will be hard to pay overtime wages because farms work on tight margins, and it could mean they have to cut workers' hours. There are about 100,000 farm workers in Washington state. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Health officials say that a lack of infrastructure has had significant health impacts on indigenous people in the state of Alaska. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The pandemic has highlighted water and sanitation needs in Alaska Native communities, where lack of infrastructure has already had significant health impacts, according to a health official. Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Interim President Valerie Davidson testified virtually this week before the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs on water infrastructure needs. Davidson says many families in rural communities do not have running water to help prevent the spread of COVID-19, like constant hand washing and cleaning. Davidson says more than 40% of Alaska Native homes lack running water.
Many communities typically have a washateria building. It's one building that combines water treatment, laundromat, toilets, and showers that the entire community uses. And what that means from a practical perspective is that those communities haul their water from the washateria in a 5-gallon clean bucket, and we haul our raw sewage from our home in a different 5-gallon bucket. And unfortunately, some of our communities continue to be unserved simply because of the high construction costs.
Among recommendations, Davidson says they desperately need at least $1 billion for sanitation construction in future legislation and resources to preserve what infrastructure is already in place. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has signed off on the Ho-Chunk Nation's plans to build a casino just north of the Illinois border. Danielle Kading reports.
Federal law gives governors the power to block or approve off-reservation casinos. The tribe's plans include one of the largest casinos in the state, along with a convention center, indoor water park, and a 300-room hotel. The complex is expected to create more than 1,500 permanent jobs and more than 2,000 construction jobs. Ho-Chunk Nation Public Relations Officer Ryan Greendeer says jobs are a central focus, as many tribal communities shut down their casinos for months last year due to COVID-19.
This is going to be the cornerstone of the economic recovery from the pandemic.
The complex will be built in the city of Beloit. Beloit City Council President Regina Duncan says the project has been a long time coming.
And is a game changer for Beloit in terms of jobs created, shared revenues, and increased tourism.
The project now faces final approval from the Department of Interior. Once approved, Wisconsin's governor and the Ho-Chunk Nation would amend the tribe's gaming compact to include revenues from the new casino. I'm Danielle Kading.
Native vote advocates in Montana are pushing back on bills they say would restrict voting access. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Bills introduced this session would end voter registration on the day of elections, require photo IDs both to register and vote in person, and restrict ballot collecting, a common practice on reservations. Keaton Sunchild with Western Native Voice says state Republicans proposing this legislation claim there was fraud in the 2020 election, despite their party's big gains in the state legislature and in the governor's office.
That's why we're just a little bit confused as to why some parts of the election seem to be okay, but some parts don't.
Lawmakers in support of these efforts have been pushing for election integrity, saying the state needs to secure its elections and that voting comes with responsibilities, such as registering before Election Day. The ballot collection bill in the legislature is nearly identical to the Ballot Interference Protection Act, which was struck down in September. Sunchild says the voting method is common on reservations, where post offices or voting locations might be far away. His group and others instead are supporting the Native American Voting Rights Act, which would lower barriers for voting, such as requiring two permanent satellite election offices on reservations.
Give Native Americans on reservations the same protections that non-reservation folks have here in Montana.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
President Joe Biden held his first press conference yesterday. He said that investment in the country's infrastructure was the next big effort for his administration. He also said that he would support reform to the Senate filibuster rules if necessary to pass a voting rights bill. With more on that story and others, here's Laura Rosborough-Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The next major initiative is to rebuild the infrastructure, both physical and technological infrastructure, of this country.
President Joe Biden told reporters at his first formal press conference yesterday that he'll unveil details about a $3 trillion infrastructure plan in Pittsburgh next week. Notably, Biden emphasized this, and not gun control, as his next big priority. The president started by saying he now aims to get 200 million COVID-19 vaccine shots to people in his first 100 days, and he expects to run for re-election in 2024 with VP Kamala Harris. Beyond that, reporters' questions largely focused on immigration, the filibuster, voting rights, and foreign policy. Before the infrastructure announcement, Biden emphasized the need to stay competitive against powers like China, who are investing more in this.
This is a battle between the utility of democracies in the 21st century and autocracies. That's what's at stake here. We got to prove democracy works.
Biden opposes the more than 250 Republican-sponsored bills restricting voting rights in states like Georgia, which passed a sweeping bill yesterday. That legislation enforces stricter voter ID requirements, limits drop boxes, and makes it a crime to offer food or water to voters waiting in lines. Republicans argue these laws are necessary to build back trust in the electoral system. The president signaled he is willing to reform the filibuster or find other ways to pass voting rights legislation, which Republicans oppose. Senate Democrats currently need 10 Republicans to support legislation to avoid a filibuster. But there are also Democratic senators on the fence. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia wants a more moderate voting rights bill and has said he might support reforming the filibuster, although Manchin has made clear he doesn't want to get rid of it.
I'd like to circle back to immigration, please.
Much of the press conference was devoted to immigration and the situation at the southern border. Biden said his administration is opening a new military facility to house unaccompanied minors, which he hopes will improve the dire conditions thousands of young people are facing. He's also launching a program he says will quickly verify whether minors crossing are reuniting with family or not. While Biden is expelling the vast majority of adults crossing the border without documentation, he is not expelling unaccompanied immigrant children, similar to past administrations before Trump. UCLA professor Raul Hinojosa just published a book called The Trump Paradox, which, among other things, analyzes U.S. attitudes toward immigrants.
The people that don't like immigrants, that have negative attitudes about immigrants, the people in counties that voted for Donald Trump are exactly the counties where there are no immigrants.
While there is a current spike in crossings, Hinojosa notes that overall, migration across the southern border has been trending down for a long time, saying the total number of people coming across has been declining for the last 20 years. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 26th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Ray Bodwell, Antonia Gonzalez, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson.